Name something that gets passed around.
A joint.
A joint.
Now, streaming live on the Marijuana Agenda.
Oh, gnarly. What are you people? On dope?
It's time for Toker Talk Radio.
Hey, this is great, man.
The voice of the marijuana nation.
Marijuana is listed as a Schedule I drug. That is absurd.
Call in now at 650-LEGAL-MJ. That's 650-534-2565.
What's to keep somebody from getting all potted up on weed and then getting behind the wheel?
Hey, man. Am I driving okay?
Toker Talk Radio is your chance to make your voice heard in the marijuana nation.
They're walking on their pants with their cap on backwards, listening to Enema Man and Snoopy Snoopy Poop Dog.
Send that message with clarity that good people don't smoke marijuana.
Now let's get to Toking and Talking with your host, Russ Belville.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. We are back here on Toker Talk Radio, Hour 2 of the Marijuana Agenda, available as podcast to VIP patrons at mjagenda.com. Following up on the rant, good to be back. Thanks for having me back, folks. And I'm checking out the live chat room here on YouTube, and Doc wanted to say a few reached out. A whole bunch of people reached out. You're right, Doc. My bad. I shouldn't have said few, and I shouldn't have said final solution either. I'm a little rusty. I've been 2 weeks off, folks. But yeah, a lot of people reached out. Thank you so much, everybody, who told me how much this show meant to you and how much you were going to miss it. And I got to be honest, that had a lot to do with me making that, all right, I'll make one more look at Patreon, right? I'd really, and Reverend out there, Roland Reverend was saying, or was it Runaround? Said that, where's that chat? Something about why didn't you mention something? Why did you just disappear? Why didn't you mention it before you disappeared? Well, I'm a little embarrassed about it, to be frank. I just really snapped. I'd had it. I was just fed up. I'd just overstressed, to be honest. And I apologize for that. You're right. I should have made a little bit more of a concerted effort to inform people about what was going on. But I was in a bad headspace, so it was probably better that I didn't, because I would have said a whole bunch of things about a whole bunch of situations, people, and organizations in my past that have led me to this space. So I decided it was better to just disappear for a sec, or 2 weeks, and get my head together. And I'm so happy that I found this Patreon platform, because already we've got some 21 people that on the first day already, 21 people that have signed up to help support the show, and my first goal is to just make $420 a month doing this. If we can get $420 a month, that'll cover the cable bill. That'll cover some of my subscriptions to software and some licensing and the domain names and the website space, and that kind of stuff. $420 a month would be good. And at $4.20 for a patronage, that works out to 100 people. Of course, fewer if some of you sign up for $9.99. And we do have some folks that have signed up for the VIP. Thank you so much for that. And we've got sponsorship levels now, too. You can sign up right there on Patreon starting at $19.99. We've got, I think, a sponsor who signed up there, another who signed up at $29.99. You sign up at those higher levels, you get a 30-second ad. We'll put a graphic ad on the website. We'll mention you on the show. And of course, the higher levels that you sponsor at, the more sponsorship you get. So please check it out at mjagenda.com. This is my, this is what I believe is the solution for the show. And we'll run it for all the rest of this year. See if we can get up to $420 a month by the end of the year. And if so, we'll just keep on doing this. And really, to me, it's about the quality of the audience and the dedication of the people that are listening to it. I had some people say, well, you know, it's going to be a paid podcast. You're going to get a smaller reach. Like, yeah, that's true. But I've been doing free podcasting for about 8 years and the reach hasn't grown. So I see no reason to keep trying beating my head against the wall and losing money doing it. So it is going to be a paid podcast, but we will put the cannabis headline news out, the 5-minute news piece for free. And that'll be our little leader to get people interested. Plus, all these segments that I'm doing, each of these segments, like the Cannabis Q&A and Marijuana Policy Insider and so forth, those are going out through their respective organizations. So like MPP is going to be distributing the Marijuana Policy Insider segment, and that has mentions of Marijuana Agenda, and we hope that brings more people. So we'll get that free distribution through DPA, MPP, SSDP, LEAP, NCIA, these guys sharing the information. We'll build the audience, we'll build more subscribers, more patronage. And if we get over 420 a month, if it starts to grow even more than that, I've got some big plans. If we can get this up to a point where it can fund it, I'll take this show on a national tour. It's been one of my dreams for years to go on a national tour and do live shows across the country, especially in places that are underserved when it comes to cannabis reform activism. Go across the northern Great Plains and down into the Great South, for example. I'd love to do that. If we can get enough patronage, enough people sponsoring, enough sponsors and supporters, there's no limit to what we can do with this show. And I keep saying we because it is we. It's you and me. This is now truly listener-supported, independent cannabis radio journalism, right? No more networks, no more promises that go unfulfilled. No more organizations aside from the ones that we are co-branding our segments with. It's you and me making a difference by putting our money where our mouth is and putting my mouth where the facts are and getting this information out to the masses. All right, thanks for joining us. When we come back, we'll take a look at legal marijuana, a $5 billion boon to California. And in the second half hour, you'll get to hear my speech from this weekend's inaugural Portland Hemp Fest Expo.
You're listening to The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Looking for the 420 friendliest way to visit beautiful legal Potland, Oregon?
I'm Lori Duckworth, inviting you to come stay with us at Delta 9 House and Studios.
You get your own private room with queen bed and access to our high-speed Wi-Fi, premium entertainment system, and more.
We'll even cook you breakfast. Look us up on Facebook at Delta 9 House.
That's facebook.com/Delta9House.
Delta 9 House is booked through Airbnb.com, City of Portland, permit number 17-159855.
Hi, I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. Putting together the most comprehensive live weekday marijuana news talk program is a full-time job. Now you can do your part to ensure that listener-supported independent cannabis radio journalism can continue by becoming a patron of the Marijuana Agenda. Just log on to mjagenda.com and click the Become a Patron button. If you're an organization or business looking to promote your brand, we have sponsorship patronage available at mjagenda.com. Sponsorship includes 15 and 30 second ad breaks and 6-minute interviews on the podcast, depending on sponsorship level, which begins at $19.99 a month. Thank you for your support, and remember, I cannot do it without you. Please become a patron today at mjagenda.com.
You're listening to The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
I'm Russ Belville from The Marijuana Agenda. Join me every Friday for the Reefer Rock Review with Herb Thrasher from 420radio.org. Learn more at mjagenda.com/about.
Shanna, your Hector David, PKA Dirtball.
It's time for Toker Talk Radio, the voice of the marijuana nation. Call in now at 650-LEGAL-MJ.
Welcome back, everybody. In this segment, we're going to talk about a piece that's in the Los Angeles Times today. Legal marijuana could be a $5 billion boon to California's economy. $5 billion to the sixth largest economy on the planet. Sounds like a good thing. But an interesting side note to the studies that have just been published by the University of California Agricultural Issues Center. states that 29% of the cannabis consumers out there are going to continue getting their marijuana from the illicit market to avoid the cost of new regulations and taxation on legal cannabis. This comes to us from the Department of No Shit Sherlock, because, folks, this is one of the problems that we've got in marijuana legalization, is that we come forth with certain promises, certain offers to the public as to why they ought to allow cannabis to be legalized. And one of the things we say is that drug dealers don't check ID, and let's have people go and taxed and regulated marijuana, right? Which is great, and it's a good thing. There's nothing wrong with that. The problem is that people have been getting their cannabis for so long under certain conditions through their illicit channels that they've got to be given an incentive to break away from those channels. And cannabis, especially the people that are using it in great quantity quite frequently, are less likely to want to turn over to some regulated system where they're going to have to pay so much more for their marijuana. I have people that come here to Delta 9 and they ask, you know, what's the price of marijuana here? Which dispensary has the best prices? Where can I get the best deal? And I have to tell them, I have no idea. I have no clue. I haven't bought marijuana in Oregon probably in about a year, at least a year. And I used to buy every now and then out at the dispensaries or the pot shops out in Washington State for a while. But lately, I've just known enough people who have cannabis that it hasn't been necessary to shop. And this is the thing, is that the established market for the chronic over once a month cannabis consumers is going to be the most resistant to legalization, because we've set up these relationships. We've got these deals brokered between ourselves and our growers or the people who are in between. And we're not the ones that are supporting the cartels or the criminal dealers, so to speak, the ones that are using the gang tactics and the violence. Throughout my entire career as a cannabis consumer since 1990, I've never been more than one or two steps away from the grow. I was either buying the cannabis straight from the grower, like I know the guy who's growing in his basement and he sells me some buds, or one step away. I know the guy who knows the guy. And for those of us that are chronic cannabis consumers, that's usually the situation. So when we legalize, the people that are going to move over to that legal market are going to be your infrequent consumers. These are going to be your people that were reticent to use cannabis when it was illegal, but now that it's legal, oh, gee, I used to do it back in the day. Let's give it another try. They don't have an established source. They don't have access. They haven't been smoking all this time. They haven't set up those relationships. They're the ones that are going to go into the pot shops. And so that's reflected in this study from the California Agricultural Issues Center. And what they show is some projections that currently 75% of cannabis purchases in California are illegal purchases. 75% of the market, 3 out of 4 purchases in the California market are on the underground. 25% of the purchases from the legal medical market. Only 1 out of 4 California purchases are from a dispensary. They are predicting, with legal recreational marijuana coming online in California, the current legal medical purchases will drop from 25% to 9% of all purchases. The current illegal purchases will drop from 75% to 29.5% of all purchases. And the legal purchases will jump from currently zero, there are no legal purchases, up to 61.5%. So they're saying that legal marijuana will only capture 70% of the market between medical and recreational. It's also interesting to note that the legal medical purchases are going to drop from 25% to 9%, and that the legal recreational are jumping up to 61%, suggesting that a lot of the people that are getting their supplies through the legal medical channels are those who will be switching to the recreational channels when that becomes available. These numbers coming from the California Agricultural Industries Center are fascinating, and they do show $5 billion coming into California. And they also kind of reiterate what I'm saying about the impact of tourists and newbies on the market. They did some marketing here, market research, and they found that there are 260 million visitors, or I should say 260 million visits to California from people that are coming from out of state. We say visits because somebody might visit twice a year, three times a year, right? So it may be fewer people because some of them have multiple visits. That might be part of the situation there. The visitors to California spend more than $122 billion a year, $122 billion, according to this Los Angeles Times piece. And tourists are expected to spend $7.2 billion a year on wine in the state of California. And according to the study, quote, given that adult use cannabis remains illegal in most other states, California's legalized adult use industry may attract some new visitors whose primary reason for visiting the state is cannabis tourism, as has been observed in Colorado, end quote. This cannabis tourism angle, again, is where the legal market is going to find most of its purchasers. They'd surveyed some tourists from Chicago, Dallas, Houston, and San Diego, and some other cities, people from those cities who had visited Colorado. This was a survey by Strategic Marketing and Research Insights. And they found that 8% of those 3,250 tourists they surveyed from illegal states, 8% of them visited a recreational use store, and 85% of them, of the whole group, not just of the 8%, but 85% of the whole group, I'm sorry, got that backwards, 85% of the 8% that visited a pot shop said that the pot shop was their primary motivator for visiting Colorado. So people are have been coming to California to enjoy cannabis for years. They're going to continue to come, and they are going to be the ones that are going to be the primary supporters of this new legal recreational market. The question then becomes, how do we get more of the underground market moved into the legal market? And I'm afraid the direction the states are going is going to prop up this illicit market for years to come. Only Massachusetts has moved forward with low taxation, like 5.75% combined, to try to undercut the underground markets. But no matter how low you set the tax, there's still going to be the overhead, the inspections, the testing that is required that is going to jack that price up greater than what people are used to paying for cannabis, or will want to pay for cannabis, or could get away with paying for cannabis once the market adjusts to undercut the testing costs, the regulation costs, the overhead costs, and so forth. And most people, you know, one of the selling points that we make is, well, you know, you want to buy from the legal market because it's tested and it's safe and you know how it's labeled and regulated. But again, that's for people that aren't currently getting cannabis and don't know what they're getting and don't know what they're looking for. If I have a relationship with a grower in Southern Oregon who grows for me Durban poison, and I've consistently gotten it at a strong enough potency for my needs, and I've consistently gotten it from them without the indications of spider mites or powdery mildew or fungus or any of these problems that you might have from cannabis, if I know my grower and I know he's or she is not using pesticides that I don't want, then what motivation do I have to want to pay extra taxes, to pay extra money to get verified what I already know? This is kind of similar to what we find in some sustainability issues where people are farming raw milk or farm fresh eggs and prevented from sharing or distributing those with people they know. This is one of the factors we're going to have to look at as marijuana legalization proceeds in this country, and the companies that build their plans and their bottom line on this, and the governments that spend their political capital on the idea of bringing in tax revenue, are going to want to thwart our right to be able to provide for ourselves and share with our friends and neighbors. This is the next big fight in marijuana legalization, and I hope that everybody out there listening is ready to take up this battle.
Man, I'm not going to any more of these bullshit Puno parties.
President Obama is so laid back these days. That sound means that it's 4:20 here in the Pacific time zone. Time for us to take our union-mandated safety briefing. And remember to check out MJAgenda.com. Our patrons get links to all of these websites and all of these stories that I talk about on the show. So you can look it up for yourself and get even more detail. We're back with my speech from Saturday's Portland Hemp Fest Expo right after this.
At Herbie's Cannabis Seeds, we pride ourselves on bringing you the best quality seeds from the world's most respected cannabis seed producers, all at the lowest online prices. You can find Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. All cannabis seeds are sold as souvenirs and as a means of preserving cannabis genetics. Herbie's Seeds in no way intends to condone, promote, or incite the use of illegal or controlled substances. We strongly urge all prospective customers to check their national laws prior to placing an order. Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. Proud sponsors of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
And now, another episode of Cannabis Shakespearean Theatre. I'm your host, Leonard Pinthgarnell III. Tonight we take a look at one of the finest works in the cannabis cinema, 1996's Half-Baked, starring David Chappelle, as interpreted by the Royal Shakespearean Cannabis Theatre Company. In this scene, Chappelle's character, Thurgood Marshall, has just admitted his addiction to cannabis to a room full of narcotics addicts. One addict, played in the film by Robert Saget, and interpreted here by the Royal Company's Sir Frederick Farrakh, takes umbrage at the suggestion.
I find preposterous the notion that you, sir, may be addicted to cannabis. In times previous, I have undertaken lubricious endeavors, most revolting and unbecoming of a proper gentleman, in my servitude to the wicked powder of the coca leaf. Lo, that is an addiction whose chains would bind Hercules. At any point in history, could one identify a moment in your life so sullied by your ignominy as a cannabis slave? Methinks not! Boo this man!
For Cannabis Shakespearean Theatre, I'm Leonard Pinthgarnell III.
The Marijuana Agenda, like the conservative agenda, minus the hypocrisy.
I'm Russ Belville from The Marijuana Agenda. Join me every 4 weeks for Shark Sessions from The Marijuana Show. Learn more at mjagenda.com/about.
I have a package here for Radical Rick. Is there a Radical Rick here? How about a Rick Russ? Any Rick Russ? Somebody named Freddie Farrakh has sent him a package. Anybody? What is that? Smells like a skunk. It's time for Toker Talk Radio, the voice of the marijuana nation. Call in now at 650-LEGAL-MJ.
All right, folks, this weekend I took part in the first annual Portland Hemp Fest Expo. It's out at the Portland Exposition Center out on Marine Drive. A bunch of booths and vendors and experts in the Oregon marijuana community include. My name is Russ Belville. I am the host of a show called The Marijuana Agenda, which is a live daily 2-hour talk radio program, news and interviews, data and analysis, all about the cannabis community, all aspects, business, culture, science, history, and health. I'm also a frequent contributor to High Times Magazine and Green State and a bunch of other websites. And I run Portland's best cannabis-friendly Airbnb, a place called Delta 9 House. So much for the lazy stoner stereotype, right? But I'm here today because it's my job to learn and read and research all about cannabis, marijuana, hemp, everything that's going on in this industry. And I've interviewed hundreds of people on this. I've written over 1,000 articles on this. And so today I want to talk about a natural substance that we all love, something that we couldn't imagine living our lives without, something that's plentiful all across this planet, used everywhere in the world, has been known since the dawn of civilization and has been used by ancient peoples and is still used today for a myriad of purposes. And that substance I'm speaking about, of course, is aluminum. Kind of took a left turn there. Not cannabis, aluminum. I want to talk about aluminum today, and you might be thinking, why the hell do you want to talk about aluminum? And the reason I want to talk about aluminum is because there's a lesson in aluminum. There's a lesson in aluminum for those of us who are in the cannabis industry, those of us who are looking at this green rush, looking at this future of cannabis commerce. And aluminum has a lesson for us. Now, aluminum is one of the most precious or the most plentiful metal in the Earth's crust. And we've known about it forever. And the ancient Greeks used it, the ancient Egyptians, the ancient Persians, they had all sorts of purposes for it. But there was a problem with this substance that they called alum. And the problem is, you couldn't find it in its pure state. Aluminum's not like gold or silver or copper, where you're going to go dig a hole and find a mother load of it in a pure state. Aluminum bonds to so many other materials, so many other types of elements like potassium and sulfur and silica. So while the ancients had used aluminum, they'd never used it in its pure form. They'd always gotten it in some sort of combination. Up until the 1800s, there was no such thing as pure aluminum. It was always in some sort of compound. But as we approach the 19th century, get around 1778, some chemists start coming up with a theory. They start figuring out there is this thing called aluminum, this material called aluminum. We can't really get a pure version of it, but in theory it must exist. But it still didn't exist. Nobody had ever seen pure aluminum. By 1807, there had been the invention of electrolysis, the process of using electricity to be able to separate materials, elements. Some of the materials that got separated were potassium, sodium, calcium, strontium, barium, and magnesium. And those chemists who'd been theorizing about aluminum figured, well, there's got to be a way to get pure aluminum with this same process. But they labored at it, and they couldn't really figure out how to get pure aluminum. Of course, here in America, we call it aluminum. Everywhere else on the planet, they call it aluminium. But same substance that we're talking about here. As time progressed, they kept working on better ways of mining aluminum, better ways of getting aluminum, separating it from the other materials. By 1825, they had managed to put together a few tiny little flakes of aluminum. And it wasn't pure aluminum, it was as close as they could get, with these little tiny flakes. But from that, they were amazed. They're like, wow, this substance, there's something to this. This is some good stuff. By 1845, they had discovered what they had made enough aluminum that they could figure out what its properties were, that it was shiny, that it was light, that it was malleable. You could bend it. It was great at distributing heat for cooking, and all these materials, all these properties of aluminum that they'd finally figured out by about 1845. By 1852, there begins a commercial aluminum industry. They start producing aluminum commercially. So in 1852, the commercial price for aluminum was $550 a pound. When you first could get aluminum, it was $550 a pound. Now, once they figured out how to make some aluminum commercially, they start producing more and more of it. By 1854, just 2 years later, they'd come up with large-scale production of aluminum. And in 1855, it became the sensation of the Paris World's Fair. They made a few marbles of aluminum. They took them to the Paris World Fair, and people freaked out. They're like, oh my God, this is shiny like silver, but it's light, it's malleable, it's bendable, there's so much we can do with it. It's amazing. They were so amazed by aluminum that Napoleon, Emperor Napoleon, commissioned aluminum plates to be made for his most respected and honored guests. Now, he had gold plates. He put the gold plates aside to give people the aluminum plates because aluminum was so amazing, so rare. So, between the 1850s and the 1880s, aluminum was a precious metal. It was like jewelry. It was like silver. But the price had come down a bit. They started figuring out better ways to manufacture it. They got it down from $5.50 a pound down to $20 a pound. Still, that's pretty expensive for what we think of as aluminum, but $20 a pound. And during that 30-year period, you got to imagine there was a whole bunch of people that got into the aluminum business. whole bunch of people that said, hey, I'll make this metal, I'll make jewelry out of it. They were literally wearing jewelry made of aluminum. So there had to be all sorts of small family jewelers that were making aluminum jewelry and aluminum plates and other sorts of fine aluminum goods. Aluminum was so revered and so wonderful that in 1884, the U.S. government commissioned a 6-pound cap of aluminum to be put on the top of the Washington Monument. And at that time, in 1884, the worldwide production of aluminum was 3.6 tons. Worldwide, that whole year, 3.6 tons of aluminum compared to 2,834 tons of silver. Now, to add to the aluminum story, something was about to break in the late 1800s that would change aluminum forever. It began with the birth of two men, one in Ohio, one in France, both born in the year 1863. The American was a guy by the name of Charles Martin Hall. The American and the Frenchman, simultaneously, not knowing each other, were both chemistry whizzes and came up with these brand new ways to extract aluminum. Revolutionary techniques to extract aluminum. And by 1886, they filed their patents on this new aluminum extraction technique. By 1886, aluminum was down to $6 a pound. Had been $5.50 just 30 years ago. Had been $20 just 20 years ago. Now it's down to $6 a pound in 1886. By the way, Charles Martin Hall later went on in 1907 to found a company called Alcoa, the Aluminum Company of America. So, once he starts doing the new extraction method for aluminum, in 1884 they are producing 22 pounds of it a day. By 1888, producing 50 pounds of it a day. By 1891, the price was below $1 a pound. Think of that. The price declined from $6 a pound to less than $1 a pound in just 5 years. By 1903, the price of aluminum was down to 30 cents a pound, which was good because in 1903, the Wright brothers were looking for some way to make a lightweight engine they could use for an airplane that they were building. Had that aluminum not been 30 cents a pound, they never could have afforded to make that engine and engage in the first flight. By 1908, they were producing 88,000 pounds of aluminum per day, up from just 22 pounds in 1884, up from just 50 pounds just 20 years prior. They were up to 88,000 pounds a day by 1908, and the price was down to 25 cents a pound. Today, 2016, latest year, 362.8 million pounds per day were produced of aluminum. The cost is 73 cents a pound, but if you weigh that in 1908 dollars, it's 3 cents a pound. A substance that started artificially scarce at $550 a pound now is down to 3 cents a pound, and they're producing 362 million pounds of it a day. So, why did I tell you all that about aluminum? Because the 2010s for marijuana are like the 1850s for aluminum. If you're planning your next 20 years on a business model that depends on $300 ounces at the retail level and $1,000 pounds at the wholesale level, you're the guy making aluminum jewelry in 1885. Because those prices aren't going to last, and they're going to drop really quick. We've already seen in Washington State, they legalized marijuana in 2012. Their initial retail price was $32 a gram on the average. Today, that retail price average is down to $9 a gram. In Oregon, we have consistently the cheapest prices for marijuana as listed on a website called priceofweed.com. They're listing it as $220 an ounce for high quality ounce. I don't know anybody that's paying $220 an ounce. I know people paying a lot less for that in Oregon. So, if that's where we're at with Oregon, Colorado, Washington, these small states, where do you think we're going to be when California mega grows come online in 2023? When they start putting together those unlimited sized fields of cannabis that they're going to put together. That price is going to decline rapidly. Now, another thing to consider is that
currently, cannabis is a Schedule I drug, which means it's federally legal, which means that any major corporation, say an Altria, a Philip Morris, for example, they don't want to get involved in marijuana right now because they could still get their ass pulled into federal court over it. And they got a whole lot of assets outside of cannabis they don't want to risk by going after the cannabis market. But boy, you drop that Schedule I designation, you make a Schedule II or Schedule III, and that's what they want. That's when the big boys come and play, because now they can dominate that market. Think of Schedule II and Schedule III drugs you know today. OxyContin. Anybody know any small family farms putting together OxyContin? Small businesses that are putting together OxyContin these days? No, it's big, big pharmaceutical corporations that are doing this. We've got GW Pharmaceuticals that's already getting its phase 3 trials together for its Epidiolex, its CBD oil. We've got Insys Therapeutics, an Arizona company that makes a fentanyl spray, which is an opioid spray, that donated $500,000 in Arizona to defeat that legalization, and then right after the election, applied for a designation from the FDA to go forward with their own medical marijuana cannabis spray. Eliminate the natural competition, kick in the corporate model. That's what's going on. So it worries me as I examine these trends and I look at the history of this and I think of aluminum and how it changed. And I got to thinking, you know, what if the guys that made aluminum back in the 1800s that were making aluminum jewelry and aluminum plates back in the day figured out that more development of aluminum would hurt their business model? And what if they actively fought against those, that French kid and that American kid who were trying to make a better way to make aluminum just to protect their profits? That's what I worry about right now, because we have sold marijuana legalization on a couple of things. We've said, hey, governments, you can tax it and make money. And we've turned to people and said, hey, entrepreneurs, you can sell it and make money. So if a government has gotten fat on a 20% tax on a $300 ounce, what are they going to do if that ounce drops to 30? If a business has built its business model on selling $1,000 pounds wholesale and that drops to $100 pounds, what are they going to do? Well, some of them will expand and grow and become the big dominant players, but the rest will be like those guys selling aluminum jewelry back in the 1880s who are going to have to find something else to do, unfortunately. And the other way I look at this is I look at how the trend has been with the development of our marijuana reforms, and how as we've lost sight of what the real purpose is, which is stop putting people in a cage for a plant, whether people make money or not, stop putting people in a cage for a plant. We get away from that and we see all sorts of strange things happen. Look at the development of medical marijuana. I look at it in four phases, right? You ever see that map they put on where they got the medical marijuana states? They're all like 29 green states up there. No, there should be four different shades of the medical marijuana states, because you can't tell me California medical is like Minnesota medical. They might as well be two completely different worlds. Here's your four phases. We start out in 1996. California passes the Compassionate Use Act, passes a medical marijuana law that says, hey, look, your doctor says you need weed, grow it and use it. That was it. There was no condition list. There was no limits. Hey, you need some weed, grow some and use it. We're fine. But then we get to the second phase. From 1998 to 2008, in that decade, we had eight more states pass medical marijuana. None of them did it like California. They all said, wait a minute. Any condition a doctor says will benefit? Oh, no, no, no. We got to have condition lists. We got to have a checklist to make sure doctors aren't just giving weed to just anybody. Why, a healthy person might be smoking it. So we had these eight states that came up with condition lists, getting the government in between the doctor and the patient. I always loved how conservatives griped about that when it came to public health care, but when it came to medical marijuana, oh no, let's get that government in there. After 2008, we had another phase. From 2010 to 2013, we had eight more states pass medical marijuana. None of them allow all patients to home grow. That was the next phase. They took home growing away from the patients. Why? We can't have you growing cannabis plants. Why? You might sell them or give them to someone who's healthy. So they came up with a dispensary system. You have to go to the dispensary. Now, there's a couple exceptions. Arizona says you can home grow plants so long as you live more than 25 miles away from a dispensary. Why? Because if I'm 26 miles away, it's good, but if I'm 24, I'm a criminal? No, it's because they want to... And they literally said this during the campaign. I was there, and I recorded the campaign guy saying, we made a 25-mile halo for the dispensaries to ensure that they would have a market. You know, because selling pot is such a risky business. So many people go out of business. Oh, we got a guarantee. Sure. That 25-mile halo has effectively made it so Arizonans cannot home grow their own medical cannabis. 97% of the population of Arizona lives within 25 miles of a dispensary. They did the same kind of thing in Massachusetts. They said you had to have a hardship exemption. If you could show that it was too difficult for you to go to the dispensary and buy your weed, then we'll let you grow. And this has expanded. They've expanded this. Nevada was one of those states in the first wave that passed medical marijuana that allowed people to grow, home grow. They took that away in 2013. They said, we're going to put a 25-mile halo up in Nevada. So people who had been home growing lost their rights. So we went from wide open California to, okay, you can home grow, but you got to have a specific condition. And then we went to, okay, no, you can't home grow and you have to have a specific condition. And now, 2014 to 2016, the fourth phase, we've got 9 more states that have passed medical marijuana. All of them are no home grow states, and 4 of them, no marijuana. We have 4 states in America that passed medical marijuana where you cannot have marijuana. Now, we'll let you have a tincture or an oil or an edible, but no buds for smoking because smoking is evil. Well, who says? The doctor? No, some bureaucrats, some lawmakers are saying this. So what we've seen in medical marijuana, again, looking at the history, is the government ratcheting down and tightening the restrictions on that in an effort to keep that control and keep that artificial scarcity to the marijuana. And I'm afraid we might see something similar in the recreational movement. Now, so far so good. 8 states passed recreational legalization, and only 2 of them, well, 8 states in D.C., and only 2 of them really messed it up. Washington State messed it up because they don't let anyone home grow, but they do have pot shops. Washington, D.C. messed it up because they let them home grow, but they can't have pot shops. So in one Washington, a shop is okay, but a home grow is not. In the other Washington, a home grow is okay, but a shop is not. Why? Well, political realities. And this is playing out in 2016, too. Vermont, which passed a legislative legalization that the governor just vetoed, Vermont passed theirs. No shops, but you can home grow. New Jersey's looking at legalization. No home grow, but you can have shops. So the trends, to me, seem to be these trends toward continuing this artificial restriction on cannabis in the name of maintaining profits, maintaining tax revenues. Speaking of profits and tax revenues, another interesting thing I've learned in my studies of this policy. Medical marijuana licensing. Oregon's done it pretty well. A few states have done it okay. But lately, the states that have passed medical marijuana have done so in a way that shows you it is all about a money grab. Since 2010, and not counting Arizona, because Arizona has some special circumstances I'm not going to get into this quickly, but since 2010, the average number of medical marijuana producers, growers, the average number of licenses in the 15 states that have passed medical marijuana since 2010 is 7.5. 7.5 growers for your state. Some states are 2, some states are 3, some states are 12, some states are 6, but the average, 7.5 growers for an entire state. Again, artificial restriction, artificial scarcity to maintain that high price. Now, in these 15 states, most of them have a process by which you apply to become a grower. And they issue what are called a non-refundable application fee, or a partially refundable, like it's going to cost you $10,000 to turn your paper in, and if we reject you, you don't get your money back. We keep the 10 grand. Because I did the research on this, I figured out how many people applied in every state versus how many licenses were granted in every state and did the math, those 15 states have raked in $10 million just from taking a piece of paper and saying no. $10 million. Then, take a look at what the annual costs are to run one of these production facilities. After you've applied your non-refundable application fee, if you did get accepted, you then have to demonstrate $500,000, $1 million, $2 million in accessible capital. You have to be able to show your surety bonds up in the $1 million range. And then you have to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars of annual fees on top of that. The average in those 15 states that have passed since 2010, the average you would spend each year, not counting the bonds and stuff, just what you'd spend, $900,000. That doesn't sound like freeing the plant to me. That doesn't sound like helping patients to me. That sounds like getting some people rich to me. And the reason that bothers me so much is because I and a lot of people who've been in this movement for over a decade aren't in here to get people rich. I didn't care who was getting rich when I was buying a bag in the parking lot of Walgreens. I don't care who's getting rich now when I'm buying at a dispensary. What I do care about is stopping the arrest and imprisonment and harassment and ruining of the lives of people who use and consume cannabis, period. I don't care if it costs us more money. I don't care if we lose money. It's wrong to lock people up for a plant, and that's why we should be doing what we are doing. I'm not in this for money. I'm in this because the Ninth Amendment says we have the right to cannabis, and nobody has the right to take that away from us. We've had our heritage stolen from us in this country. The first hemp plantation in this country was 1611 in the Jonestown colony. We've had hemp for over four centuries on this continent. Medical marijuana got its revival in 1850 with Dr. O'Shaughnessy. We've had medical marijuana in this country since 1850. In fact, it was in the U.S. Pharmacopeia for 90 years. It's only been prohibited for 80. It was medicine longer than it was prohibited. And we've had recreational cannabis since 1900. If you look back to King Oliver and Louis Armstrong and Cab Calloway singing about the reefer man and jive. So that's our culture. And our culture's been taken from us, stolen from us, by what was originally timber companies and paper companies, what is now oil companies and pharmaceutical companies. But it's been taken from us in the name of profit. So, in closing, I just want to remind you about that story of aluminum and how a very precious and wonderful commodity that was artificially scarce became very plentiful and very cheap in a very short time. And to remember that that search, that all-consuming search for profit is going to doom this movement if we don't recall why we're in this. And it's not about who gets rich. It's about not locking people up and ruining their lives over a plant. It's our right. It's our heritage. And we need to reclaim it. I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. Thank you for taking the time to listen to me. Have yourselves a great PDX Hemp Fest. And check me out at mjagenda.com. If you need a card to remember that, I've got some cards right here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, my speech at the Portland Hemp Fest Expo. You can learn more about Hemp Fest and getting one in your area by visiting hempfest.org. Stay tuned. We'll be back with one more segment here to close out the show. Glad to see so many people in the chat room hanging out. Sorry about that software crash. Glad it popped back up, though. So still working things out here at Delta 9.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
New beginner guitars and banjos are often constructed much better than ones built before your time. Why struggle? Get a new instrument or fix the old one. The trusted professionals at the Fingerboard Extension will evaluate your instrument for free. Repairs are priced for people who work for a living. Stop by the Fingerboard Extension downtown Corvallis at 120 Northwest 2nd Street today or check out its inventory on the web at fingerboardextension.com.
Hi, I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda.
Putting together the most comprehensive live weekday marijuana news talk program is a full-time job. Now you can do your part to ensure that listener-supported independent cannabis radio journalism can continue by becoming a patron of the Marijuana Agenda. Just log on to MJAgenda.com and click the Become a Patron button. For your $4.20 monthly donation, you'll receive over 20 hours of original first-hour podcasts, plus other materials only available to paid subscribers. Or for just $9.99 a month, become a VIP patron. You'll get over 40 hours of podcasts for the complete program, including Toker Talk Radio, plus ad-free downloads of the segments heard on the Marijuana Agenda. Plus, VIPs get exclusive access to the video replay of the two-hour live stream show and downloads of the spreadsheets and charts I provide from my years of curating marijuana data sets. Thank you for your support, and remember, I cannot do it without you. Please become a patron today at MJAgenda.com.
The Marijuana Agenda, Kevin Sabet's boogeyman since 2012.
You have offended my family, and you have offended Shaolin Temple.
Yes, might have gotten away with it too, if it wasn't for these blasted kids and their dogs.
I'm Russ Belville from The Marijuana Agenda. Join me every 4 weeks for the UK Cannabis Chronicle from the UK Cannabis Social Clubs. Learn more at mjagenda.com/about.
Most of us pirates, we go on vacation to North Dakota, you know, because they've got a town called Argusville. Arr. What are you smoking there, boy?
It's time for Toker Talk Radio, the voice of the marijuana nation. Call in now at 650-LEGAL-MJ.
All right, to close out the show today, I want to revisit our top story in the news as delivered by Tom Angel out at massroots.com in an exclusive. Jeff Sessions, the Sling Blade Hobbit, our Keebler Gump Attorney General, has requested that Congress remove the Rohrabacher-Blumenauer Amendment, formerly the Rohrabacher-Farr Amendment, the amendment that protects the states, the medical marijuana states, from prosecution by the Department of Justice. Specifically, it says that they may spend no money going after prosecuting the states that are operating their medical marijuana programs. And Tom's done some fantastic reporting on this. It's an amazing piece. I'll have the link up at mjagenda.com on our episode show, or episode post, I should say. But yeah, he wants to pull the Rohrabacher-Farr Amendment when we get around to the next budget vote so that the Department of Justice's hands aren't tied when it comes to going after medical marijuana states. And I've said time and time again, it makes a difference who you vote for. And this Jeff Sessions is giving every indication that he wants to go after marijuana. It's in all of his speeches, all of his rhetoric, all of his history, all of his votes. He hates pot. And he wants to come after us. And this is the latest evidence of that. And a couple of other things to note that Tom Angel brings up. Congress, when they passed the Rohrabacher-Farr Amendment, it's been the past three fiscal years it's been passed. But when President Trump signed that this time around, he added a signing statement. You remember signing statements, right? And his signing statement said, quote, "I will treat this provision consistently with my constitutional responsibility to take care of the laws, be faithfully executed." So Trump is basically trying to say, yeah, I'll follow this law unless my constitutional duty says that I shouldn't. And of course, they would argue that the Controlled Substances Act is constitutional. His duties to uphold the federal law and busting people for marijuana falls under that duty. Also, consider that when President Trump made his budget request to Congress, the most recent budget pile of crap that he put across that gives tax breaks to millionaires, bloats the military, and guts social safety nets, that one, nothing in there about Rohrabacher-Farr, nothing about keeping that in there as well. So omission of that protection. But I just wanted to read to you the actual letter, because Sessions, Attorney General Sessions, sent this letter to Congress, the leadership in the House and the Senate about specifically about this Rohrabacher Farr Amendment saying it should be stricken. And keep in mind that the Obama Justice Department wasn't much better on this. They had argued that the restriction was only for them to prevent the laws from being enacted, not from actually busting people who are running dispensaries. And it was the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that ruled that, no, what Congress said was don't mess around with state medical marijuana, and that meant people that were running dispensaries and following the law. Now, the little catch on this is that the Ninth Circuit ruling only appeals to the Ninth Circuit. That's the Western states with medical marijuana laws. Wouldn't apply to going and busting someone in Massachusetts or Michigan or Florida. So this is still a very tenuous situation as it is with Rohrabacher Farr. And now you got Sling Blade Hobbit there, Jeff Bow the third, gunning for this amendment, trying to get rid of it. And so here is Sessions' letter, as reported by Tom Angel out at Massroots.
Dear Senators McConnell and Schumer, Speaker Ryan and Representative Pelosi, I write to renew the Department of Justice's opposition to the inclusion of language in any appropriations legislation that would prohibit the use of Department of Justice funds or in any way inhibit its authority to enforce the Controlled Substances Act. As you know, the most recent continuing resolution contained a rider that restricts the department from using appropriated funds to prevent certain states, quote, from implementing their own state laws that authorize the use, distribution, possession, or cultivation of medical marijuana, end quote. Even though marijuana remains unlawful under the Controlled Substances Act. Last year, and over the department's objections, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit interpreted this provision broadly to apply both to department actions that prevent states from implementing their laws regarding medical marijuana and to department prosecutions of certain individuals and organizations that operate under those laws. The court held that the department may not prosecute violations of the Controlled Substances Act with respect to marijuana unless a court concludes that the individuals or organizations are not in compliance with state medical marijuana law. As a result, in the Ninth Circuit, many individuals and organizations that are operating in violation of the Controlled Substances Act and causing harm in their communities may invoke this rider to thwart prosecution. I believe it would be unwise for Congress to restrict the discretion of the Department of Justice to fund particular prosecutions, particularly in the midst of an historic drug epidemic and potentially long-term uptick in violent crime. The department must be in a position to use all laws available to combat the transnational drug organizations and dangerous drug traffickers who threaten American lives. Smoking marijuana in a Drug traffickers already cultivate and distribute marijuana inside the United States under the guise of state medical marijuana laws. In particular, Cuban, Asian, Caucasian, and Eurasian criminal organizations have established marijuana operations in state-approved marijuana markets. These individuals and these organizations often find a place for themselves within state regulatory systems. Smoking marijuana, in addition, has negative health effects, significant negative health effects. According to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, marijuana use is linked to an increased risk of psychiatric disorders such as psychosis, respiratory ailments, and IQ loss, and substance use disorder and addiction. I respectfully request you oppose the inclusion of such language in department appropriations. Do not hesitate to contact me if you have any
follow
questions.
Follow MJ Agenda on Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, YouTube, and SoundCloud. And follow MJ Agenda Show on Twitter. Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
Well, folks, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for having me back. Glad to be here. See you tomorrow. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.
You plant it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth.